Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to This Is Your Racing Life. And today we talk the racing life of Robert Lang. Robbie Lang, how you doing, Rob?
Yeah, very well, thanks, Brian.
Lovely property down here. We're on site. We're down here at Piercedale. And how many acres have you got out here? It's a beautiful day for it.
Yeah, 20 acres, undulating property with good grey sandy loam and grows good grass and got a beautiful house and got 10 of our favourite horses here at the back door.
How many children?
At the back door? No. 8 in total.
Yeah, so how many on site?
The three youngest girl, Rachel's girls, they're all live here with us. And Jack, my youngest son, he works for me now and he's in the bungalow.
Now, tell us about Grace. She's carving a nice little career in singing.
Yeah, she's going really well. Had a bit of a theory on it. I thought I could sing as a kid. And I think my old man thought it was a bit feminine for his son to be a singer and used to say, shut up, you got no voice at all. So it crushed me. So when I was harrowing the track out at Lyndhurst of a night, Grace would come with me and I had a Beach Boys CD and I had her singing Californian Girls. And I remember one night I said to Rachel, I said, she can really sing this, kid. She goes, oh, yeah, like her father. I said, no, I'm telling her she can really sing. So one thing she got off me was a great memory, which helps when you got to sing a long song. So we wrote the Californian Girls down every word and had her singing the whole song when she was about 3.5, 4. And, yeah, the first time we saw her in public, we got invited to grandparents' day at Halebury, and I thought, they've gone off a bit half-cocked here. I'm not a grandparent yet. And I was standing up the top of the stadium with Jimmy Biggins, Alan Williams' racing manager, and he goes, oh, Act 3. Robbie, your daughter. I said, that's why we're here. And they gave her, I think she was 9 or 10, and they gave her Rolling in the Deep, Adele's song, and just had, the women had tears in their eyes and the men all just rose and clapped. And you can hear, I taped it off my phone and you can hear Jimmy Biggin say, best bloody horse you've ever trained, Langy.
Where did it go from there?
Well, a couple of years later, she ended up on The Voice Kids and finished in the top four. And Delta was her mentor. She won a trip to America. We all went over last year, 2015, I think it was, yeah. And went and visited Delta at her home in Hollywood. She's a lovely girl. Met her manager and did all the American things. Went to Universal Studios and Disneyland and what have you. So that was great. And Delta keeps in touch with Grace on a regular basis now.
And is she at the end of schooling now? She done a year 12?
Yes, she's just completed year 10.
Oh, but, 10, okay.
Yeah, but she's doing year 11 now. They're a bit different to my day at school. She started year 11, and it just must be an introductory course. So she started year 11 at Halebury, as we speak.
Yeah. Is she going to pursue it? Because it's a tough business, show business. But having that talent, if you can get it right and get into the right stable, as they say, it can be fantastic for you.
Yeah, look, she's got a lot of talent, got a bit of an unusual voice, a bit raspy, which I think gives her a bit of an edge. But she's with David Jantz, who's a well-known singing teacher, and he generally quinellas the voice or the X Factor with his students. And, yeah, Grace is a favourite of his. He tips her to have a big future. She got with a couple of fellas, Michael Painter and another Michael, I forget his name now, M Squared, and they put together a song 12 months ago called Ride Away, which Grace was instrumental in writing it and singing. I think it's a terrific song. I've heard it on the radio a couple of times. And it was 2015, Oaks Day, Jimmy Cassidy's last ride, taking it to the news, was Ride Away. So that's a terrific song, and she's just recently written one about Michelle Payne.
Oh, beautiful. Look forward to hearing that. So who knows what the future holds there. Now, what about Robbie Lang? I read we're going back through the 70s. You were a pretty handy footballer, played VFL with Morty Alec.
Oh, yeah, probably lucky. I was a precocious kid. You know, the old man was, I think he was a handy footballer. I mean, I never seen him play, but he wanted his kid to be a good footballer. I know that. So the drills in the backyard, stab kicks, left foot, right foot, blind turns, when I pulled the Guernsey on for the under 11s, they were up against a pretty pretty streetwise under 11. I won the league's best and fairest by 25 votes. So I think I'd won about five or six best and fairest by the time I was 14. But that was a funny stage of my life because I didn't grow. I was too small to be a footballer, and so naturally going to be a jockey, and left school at 15 and had 53 rides. I was a terrible jockey. Didn't know where I was. Won one race. But I'll tell you what I did do. I don't give jockeys impossible instructions. Through being out there and probably through being ordinary at it, I know how difficult it is. So I think that was a plus for my training career. But I had my last ride when I was 17. I pulled a stone of weight off using Lasix tablets and what was the other one we used to use to hit ourselves up? I think it ended up was a flash name for speed. So you'd go to the races dehydrated and off your head, and that's the jockeys right across the board. So I had my last ride on a Newmarket handicap day. I rode at 54. The coach of the under 18s come around a fortnight later and said, "Oh, hey, you're not riding anymore." I said, "No." He said, "Come down to Mount Eliza on Saturday. We're a bit short on numbers for the under 18s. I said, "No, I want to play under 17s. He said, "Oh, you'll be right." So Eddie got me down there 10 minutes into the game. The game had started, and they said, "Well, jump over the fence. You're on." And I ended up, I got best on the ground that day, and I won the league's best and fairest in the under 18s. So I was pretty proud of that because I hadn't played for 4 years. And
not too many jockeys have done that in their time.
No, well, 2 years later, the Saturday football on the Mornington Peninsula was really interfering with Eddie's horses racing on a Saturday.
Now, Eddie's your dad, Eddie Lang, and a very, very successful trainer.
Yeah, Mr. Fix-It. He used to get all the horses that were broken down and make them right, horses like
Taxan, yep.
Taxan, Saxon Slough, to name a few. But, I went to Mordialloc. I remember I bypassed Carrum Football Oval and I got to Nepean Highway and I went inny, minny, miny, mo. Will I go to Frankston VFA or Mordialloc? So I went to Mordialloc and they were doing circle work and a big chap came up. He said, "Join in, son. Can you kick a ball?" I said, "Oh, a little bit." He said, "My name's Les Foote." And he was a former champion North Melbourne footballer. And the coach that year was Paul Feltham, who had played in North Melbourne's grand final. And yeah, I just sort of buggerised around a bit because I didn't know anybody. And then we played Paran in a practice match and I actually let loose and got 30 kicks and kicked a few goals and was recruited for 3 years at Mordialloc.
Did you ever think that you might get to sort of the major league and playing, you know, eventually AFL? It would have still been VFL back in those years, but, was racing drawing more on you to come back and work with your dad?
Yeah, I never really thought of playing VFL. I always thought I was too short until one day when I'd finished playing football, I stood next to Paul Callery and I was a giant over the top of him. But I played against blokes like Jared Healy and that. You know, they were gun junior players, same year as myself. And, went on to win Brownlows and stuff like that. But, no, I think racing was my first choice. And playing, going to the races on a Saturday, never really seriously entertained a VFL career.
Mm. Now, working with your father, foreman for your father in your 20s, obviously, I see your first winner as a trainer was Ben Criado in September of 1980. That's going back a few years at Werribee and a flying. So how long had you had your licence by the time you got the... It might have been your first runner, was it?
Yeah, it was, actually. Yeah.
Oh, nice setup.
Well, bit of a story to Ben Criado. I bought the mare when I was 17 under Brian Russell's advice from Racetrack magazine. You had to get Royal Charger or his three-quarter brother Nasrallah over Prince Quillo Blood, and that had produced Mill Reef and Secretariat. So I bought a mare with Prince Quillo Blood pretty high up in her bloodline. Wanted to go to a Nasrallah stallion. I had my eyes on Orgoglio or Rego, but they'd both passed away. But down on the Mornington Peninsula was a Royal Charger stallion called Powerhouse, and he was a very good stallion too. Mm. Versatile. He had horses like Maritana, Nandelli Lass, and the Brilliant Hurdler, Lots of Time, also was by Powerhouse. So got involved to Powerhouse and out jumped a sprightly bay colt. And there was a star two-year-old. That was Ben Criado. But I was only 19, so I worked. He broke him in, rode him every morning, but Dad trained him. And then when I got my licence in June or July, when I turned 21, my first runner in a race, Ben Criado, Werribee Sprint, and got the money.
He was a wonderful horse, Ben Criado. He had a good few seasons of racing. I remember him well. He was a top flight sprinter, sort of out to 1400. Did he get out to 1600?
Yeah, as a 3-year old, the opposition jockeys knew if they took him on, they could beat him. So I ran him in a mile high weight at Sandown as a 3-year old. I think he got 65 kilos, took three off with Mark Withers, and absolutely bolted in, beat Zegna. And then a fortnight later, won the metric mile by about 6 lengths, led all the way, beat Heartstrings, and a pretty smart field. But he went on to win a Tattersall's Mile in Tassie, beat Haneke's Gentleman in record time, beaten a nose in a Victoria Handicap, broke down, had 2 years off, and come back after he'd served two seasons at stud, and won the City of Caulfield. He had to be cajoled into winning by Michael Riley, and beat Sports Ruler in the City of Caulfield at 8 years of age.
I remember your dad training as well, and you mentioned your dad was the patch-up trainer. They called him the Mr. Fix-It. But, gee, he was a terrific horseman, Eddie. I recall Taxan came to him after winning a Caulfield Cup, trained by Tommy Smith. Saxon Slew was another one that won a Moonee Valley Cup. Horses that he could sort of rejuvenate, rehab, and get them back to the races.
Yeah, it was funny because didn't have a lot of horses in work. He was only doing it part-time, and Powers Tour was the first horse he trained, won 13 races, and then a horse called Voltage, which he patched up. I think Jeff Murphy and Bonnie Hoisted had him had bad knees, worked him on the beach and turned him around. And then his first couple of decent horses were Stamboul and Big Angel. Mm. Big Angel was a great story. It'll take too long to talk about him, but he got beat in a maiden hurdle at Hamilton in January, and we got him as a lead pony in March, and he was third favourite for the Melbourne Cup in September after he'd won the Herbert Power by three. He'd won the Metropolitan. He won three staying races in the middle of winter by an aggregate of 25 lengths, and I don't know, the penny just dropped with him or something, but he was Dad's first real good horse. But in the end, he was getting horses with tendons and joints, and I remember one bloke rang up one day and he said, "Eddie," he said, "I hear you're pretty good with horses with bad legs." He said, "I'm a lot better trainer if they got good legs."
But he got them going, didn't he?
Yep. Yeah. Well, you know, just long work, long, slow work, which he'd been taught from his boss, Des McCormick. And then he was with George Jesser in Adelaide, who trained Royal Gem. And then he spent a good bit of his career with Dick Campbell at Mount Gambier. And he tells me they used to trot and canter 5 kilometres to the track, gallop them, hose them, trot and canter home. And he said he was, you know, a terrific trainer.
Robbie Lang. We're talking to Robbie Lang this morning. This is your racing life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Rob Lang is my special guest here this morning. We're down at the property here at Piercedale on a beautiful sunny morning it is. Rob, we're talking about your dad, Eddie Lang, and I recall a wonderful sprinting horse he had called Corbeau, who was in the same era as a champion in Manicato. So he followed Manicato a few times.
Yes, he did, and he'd left me home to do the work. He went over to the Adelaide sales. Mum and Dad used to drive over with the Allens, Kyle Allen and his wife Jill. And I don't know whether he'd been on the terps or not, but he rang me up and he said, "I've bought two beautiful colts. I'll be home tomorrow afternoon. Make sure you're there at the stable to unload them." He said, "And give us a ring when you've had a look at them." I was breaking in at the time and riding work for Dad. Anyway, the transport parked in Valletta Street, couldn't get up the driveway, it was just a house block where we trained from. And the first one got off was by Authentic Air, and I didn't like it. Had a bit of a buff head, and I don't know, didn't have much of a hind leg on it. And the next one got off, had a magnificent head, great big forelock, wide between the eyes, lovely jowl on him. And I looked down, and he's off front. His knee nearly sat onto his near front, had a completely twisted leg. And then he was base wide, you know, his feet were a good way apart, but his off front knee sagged in and actually touched his left knee. Anyway, Eddie rings me up, or Dad rings me up later that night. He said, "What did you think?" I said, "You must have been on the drink." I said, "I don't like the Authentic Air colt." I said, "The other one, did you have a look at its legs?" And he goes, "Oh, don't worry about its legs. And he got a beautiful head." And I said, "Do you really want me to break him in?" He goes, yeah, break him in. So I didn't think that sort of amount to much. I reckon I broke Corbowin in 3 days, tied his head down day one, drove him on day two. And I can remember Dad was coming back around the roads from road work on Learmonth Lad, and I met him. He goes, "What are you doing on it?" And I said, "Oh, it's quiet as a mouse." I said, "We should trial this thing and get rid of it. You know, it won't stand with that off front." But, gee, I remember R.B. Martin galloped him one morning. He said, "Don't worry about that horse with the twisted leg." He said, it's a superstar. So he won his first start at Cranbourne by five. And then he went on Caulfield Cup Day almost in record time, over 1,200. And then went on to be a superstar sprinter. Won the CF4 Stakes, the Churnside. He won the William Reid, beating Ideal Planet. Beaten a nose by Manicato in the... what's it called?
William Reid.
The William Reid, yeah. Superstar horse, and that leg never worried him.
It's amazing, isn't it? The horseman's eye, you know, but there must be some innate sort of part of the horseman that recognises, you know, they can still get into the races and turn them out.
Yeah, well, several years later, I'd trained a horse in 1990. I got him off George Hanlon called Strawberry Ranch, and the horse couldn't breathe. And, you know, George, great trainer, but wouldn't be up on the horse's back. So I advised the new owners to get the horse throat surgery. And he came back to win a Standish and beaten a nose in a William Reid, third in a Lightning, fourth in an Oakley Plate. Very good sprinter, Strawberry Ranch. Anyway, the owner said, "Oh, you've done such a good job. Get us two yearlings at the Melbourne sale." So I took it very professionally, stayed out at the other side of town for a week, going through the whole catalogue. Was set on two horses, bought a Rancher filly and bought a colt by Dalmacia out of a Biscay mare. Thought I'd bought really well. I think it was the last day I noticed Mum and Dad turn up. Just sit there in the auditorium. I said, "Out here for a look?" And Dad said, yeah, got no money, just going to have a look. And all of a sudden this colt walked into the ring. He goes, "Oh, the head on that horse." I said, "Have you had a look at him?" He goes, "Oh, it doesn't matter." Put his hand up, 25, and I thought, God, I've done the right thing and bought two nice horses. I'm going to have all the luck in the world. Poor old Daddy's bought this thing. Be interesting to see what it looks like. Well, my two, they died maiden platers, and the horse in question was Loranto. It was just unbelievable. And I said, "Well, what did you like about his head?" He said, "You don't see horses with heads like that running at Stony Creek."
Oh, very handy horse too, Loranto.
Yeah, beat Naturalism in the Autumn Stakes, second in Australian Guineas to Jolly Old Mac, and then went to the West and sired Plaster to come back over here and won a Victorian Derby.
You're a devotee of the pedigree page. You love to delve back into the pedigrees and go way back, and you mentioned before about the Royal Charger bloodline and also Powerhouse. And that's terribly important. A lot of trainers probably don't get the time to do that and rely on outside advice and, you know, professional advice as far as pedigrees go. They can see the type, you know, and the questions that's always raised when you go to the sales, do you look at the pedigree page or do you buy them on type? Do you try and combine the both?
Yeah, 100%, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can buy an athlete with not much of a pedigree and have luck with them. And a little bit vice versa. You can buy a horse with a great pedigree that you can see needs time or he's been presented badly and you'll get a bargain that way. I bought a horse one year. He was by a Biscay stallion called Power Symbol and he was out of a mare by Morstan. Well, I spoke to a few other trainers. I didn't have a clue who Morstan was. I said, "He won an English Derby." I said, "He had two half-brothers that won English Derbies as well, if you want to know." And I remember he looked so poor. I hid behind a pylon at the sales and they said, "Come on, we're not going under 1,000. 1,000 or he's out of the ring." I put my hand up, bought him for 1,000. That was a really handy horse called Takano. Won several times in Melbourne.
$1,000.
Yep.
Yeah. What's your take on the money that, you know, goes through the sale ring now, particularly at the Sydney Easter and the Magic Millions? You see it, and there's a history of it. Those high-price yearlings, $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, the record and the return is shocking. Like, you look at the bottom line, yet it continues on. What's your take on that? You watch it very carefully.
Yeah, I've got a theory on it.
But what's your theory?
Well, the horses that bring the big money have obviously got a great pedigree, but they're generally big, imposing yearlings. And I like to buy a yearling that's going to go home and improve. If you buy a big 500-kilogram yearling colt by Redoute's Choice or whatever, he's only going to get bigger. And this day and age, for some unknown reason, they generally have wind problems if they're too fat and too heavy. And 20 or 30 years ago, you would have gelded them. And probably a lot of these high-priced yearlings have been unsuccessful. They gelded the week after the sales. They would have been really good racehorses. But the big money in racing is syndicating stallions. So it's a weird one, but that's my theory on it.
And a lot of people will say, you know, that big strapping colt that you bought at the sales in March, and like 2 months later, you look at the same horse in the paddock, it's a different horse.
Yeah, they deflate like a balloon.
Look, it's not all the time, but it does happen, as we say. Rob, racing as it goes now, it's always been tough. How tough is it for a guy like yourself competing against the bigger conglomerates? You know, you're a Cranbourne based man. You've got new stables being built on site at Cranbourne. How is it now?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty excited about the new 40 boxes on course because I'm into my 35th year as a trainer. I've never, ever trained on course. We've always floated horses either from Carrum to Epsom and then later Lyndhurst to Epsom and then Lyndhurst to Cranbourne. And then I had spent 2 years up at Sutton Grange, which was off course, but a beautiful setup at Peter Sidwell's. And then back to Cranbourne, but we're at Pearstall, so we do a lot of floating, a lot of petrol, a lot of maintaining trucks. A lot of mornings where the truck breaks down and the jockeys wander off, you can't use them. So really excited about having our hands on 40 horses. But, yeah, I'm not going to change. I'm too 35 years into it. I love to be there involved in the saddling up and the hosing and see how they pull up and check their feet, check their heels and see if they've got a girth gall or a boil on their back. So, the new trainer, and look, I'm not discrediting them at all. They're great communicators, sending videos of track work and audios. I'm doing audios now, though. I find that very easy. The MyStable audio saves a lot of phone calls and a lot of angst with my owners if they just hear an audio what their horse did and where it's going. So I've sort of come along in that degree. The girls in the office do a good job. But racing, still a great product, but gee, it's saturated. I've had to pull up. I used to go, I couldn't believe that I have races so close to home now and I don't go, physically can't go. We start at 3. If I have to drive 2 hours now, I've got to give it a miss because I just go to sleep. It's dangerous. So,
and the night racing in vogue now at Moonee Valley, at Pakenham and at Cranbourne. Cranbourne and Pakenham's probably pretty easy for you this side of town. But gee, Moonee Valley would be a nightmare from here, surely.
I don't go to Moonee Valley, personally. It takes our horses 2.5 hours to get there now of a night. There's a good argument to say maybe we should have 20 boxes on course so we could leave at lunchtime and get the horses there swiftly. I've had horses lose races in the float at Moonee Valley. 2.5 hours on the float, stop, start, and get there, you might as well scratch them. It's pretty tough. It's tough on the pocket, too, because you have a certain amount of people go to the races on Thursday to Pakenham. You can't line them up for track work at 3 o'clock the next morning, so you've got to get subbies in. And then we go to Cranbourne Friday night. By the time the horses go back to their boxes, it's midnight. Saturday morning's an important gallop morning. More fill-in staff. And then races Saturday and 2 meetings on a Sunday. Trials generally on a Monday. Yeah, it's... I don't know where it's heading. We love it, but there's a lot of it.
Yeah, that's a fair call. The partnership training is totally in vogue now. It's been very popular in New Zealand in years gone by, but Colin and Cindy Alderson were the first to sort of break the mould here in Victoria. Would you contemplate something like that? I know you've got your son Jack coming through the ranks, but it might be some time off before he'd be ready. But would you do something like that, do you think, down the track?
Yeah, probably look at it. Yeah,
who could actually put up with you?
Oh, probably no one. I probably should have done it. When Eddie retired at the age of 70, if it was around then, would have been a great combination. He loves the races, won't miss a race meeting. And unless my horses are a chance and it's within an hour radius, I'd prefer to watch it on TV. And that would have been a great combination. Jack, he's not 21 yet. I wouldn't put him under that pressure just yet, and would really like to see what sort of a love he's got for it. And you know, you've got to be able to manage staff as well as horses.
It's intoxicating too, isn't it? Like, it's there's no 40 hours a week.
Oh, that's right. You know, Jack's, you know, had the odd girlfriend, and you know, that's one of the big problems. You know, they want to go to a movie Saturday night, and he's like me already. He's asleep at 7:30 in a chair at his girlfriend's parents' house. So, yeah, that's a very special partner you got to pick as well.
Robbie Lang is my guest this morning on This Is Your Racing Life. We'll be back in just a moment. We're here for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating life. Robbie Lang is my guest this morning. This is Your Racing Life. Rob, the good horses, you know, and they're hard to get, of course, but horses that have come through the stable that I recall, Cindy's Appeal, Green Aga, Bahrain, Mantelpiece. I love Mantelpiece. And I love that filly called Perfect Bliss, although you beat a horse that we had called Fear the Game at Flemington one day. Didn't love you that day. But what about Perfect Bliss? What's her story?
Well, second season daughter of Sharp Edge, a terrific galloper in Ireland, and Dad went out to the sales with a client that had plenty of money, Simon and Denise Scher, and bought a beautiful grey filly by Sharp Edge from Barcarolle, for memory, a small-time mare. And I broke it in. Oh, God, it was a bugger of a thing to break in. It used to throw itself down backwards, and it was in reverse more than forwards and limited ability. Anyway, 12 months down the track, I'm laying on the lounge room floor reading the Herald Sun, and Eddie's watching TV. And Mrs. Moore, the part owner of Northern Nymph, who I trained, was on the phone. She said, "Oh, Sylv, ask Eddie, has he got room for our Sharp Edge filly? John Sudak half owns it with me, but it's giving the staff out there at Tool and Vale a hell of a time." And she goes, "Hang on, Phyllis, Eddie, Mrs. Moore wants you to try." He goes, "No, full up." And he pointed to me. I had my head in the newspaper, and I heard my mum say, "Eddie's full up, Phyllis, but Robbie would love to train it." And I sat up and I went, "Really?" Anyway, down she came, and beautiful skinned horse, not very big, 15-1. Jumped on it, and we're right in the early building part of stages at Glasscox Road, and Kyle Allen was there actually building fences and what have you, and I jumped on the filly and throwing the reins at her, and pretty cocky, and it's not going to do anything wrong with me. It just went bang, red, and flipped straight over backwards on top of me, and it got up and sort of shook itself, and I get sand in my eyes, and I said to Cole, "Give us that lump of polypipe, will you, Cole?" He said, "Oh, you're going to give it a lacing," and he thought I was going to jump on and pull the stick like a race day jockey. Anyway, up in the air she went again, and I give her a smack right across the ears. I don't know whether that's to be condoned, but she shook her head for a couple of minutes, and you know what, never did it again. Won her first trial by 6, won her first race at Cranbourne by 5, won her next 5 in a row after that.
If I remember rightly, she used to run off the track.
Had a, what'd they say, a cyst in her near front knee. And the deeper she got into her preparation, the more it would become inflamed. And she'd run away from it and get off the track. People used to think it was a mongrel side of her. I think she was just looking after herself. And when she won the 1,000 guineas, the official winning margin was 5.5 lengths. It was very deceptive, the angle. And I said to the boys at Simon Studios, "Oh, I'd love a big picture of that for the billiard room." And he rang back, and I think it was Phil from Simon Studios, and he said, "All we've got is Brendan Clements' boot and the horse's number." He said, "We didn't get any decent shots of her at all. She was so close to the camera."
On the outside fence in a miserable wet day.
Yeah, very wet Caulfield Cup day it was. Hey, I won the Caulfield Cup that day.
Yeah, I remember it well. And she went on, and you sort of lost track with her after she'd finished racing, but she was a terrific mare for you, a classic winning mare, as you say, a Group 1 winner. But later in life, you'd be United.
Yeah, she had several homes. She ended up in New South. She was going to have a sale-topping colt by Biscay, and apparently pulled back and broke his neck or something, and didn't have a lot of luck. She had a good horse called a Xanadu by Carriman, another one called Regal Rapture, and second in a Villiers in Sydney. And she ended up at Ian Pankhurst's at Pakenham, and he retired her from the breeding barn when she was about 23. So I knew she was at Ian's property, or whether she was still there or not, didn't matter. And I was driving past one afternoon, and I seen this chestnut mare cordoned off in a special part of the paddock by herself, and I thought, God, that looked like perfect bliss. So I pulled the car up and climbed through the fence, and I wet down her left shoulder. I was looking for the brand's NS after Nicholas Sudak, John Sudak's son, and sure enough, it was her. And I rang Ian up. I said, what's wrong with the mare? And he said, oh, fancy you finding her. And I said, oh, well, the big white star on her head and not very big was a bit of a dead giveaway. And he said, I think she's got some liver disease. And he said, and we just got her quarantined. And I said, can I have her? And he said, what? I said, can I have her? He said, oh, you're more than welcome to. So I got the float, picked her up, and the vet, she had an infection somewhere inside. I forget, it might have been her liver. And had her treated, and she lived another couple of years. She lived till she was 29, and the girls were only very young then. And I got a lovely photo of all three riding around our property at Cannons Creek at the time. Yeah, so yeah, she ended up, she succumbed to old age, and she actually died in my arms when being euthanized. So that was a pretty sad moment.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah, it was something like you read in a book, but she was good to me, and the least we could do for the last couple of years of her life was give her a good one.
Coming closer to today's racing, 2009, the Grand Annual with Sir Pentire. That was a fantastic training performance because the horse ran the quickest time since 1997 in the Grand Annual won by Fox Boy. And you'd got him to win that race that year. But you never got the accolades, connections, but particularly you as a horseman never got the accolades because it was the high drama of the anti-jumping lobby that was moving, and the jumping sort of racing here in this state was tittering on the edge, like it could go one way or the other. I think Rob Hulls was racing minister, and for a moment there was as though jumping racing was going to be abolished. So it was an anti-climax in so many ways, but what a training triumph that was that day.
Yeah, it was something I'd always hoped I'd be able to do. I can remember rehabbing Taxan down the beach for Dad, and I just thought to myself, I wonder when we'll get him back winning. You know, I reckon I could do enough on Taxan to have him winning, like Tullock did after 2 years off, first up at 2,000 metres. But it was the done thing in Australia, you know, 1,200, 1,400, 1,600 and so on. Anyway, Sir Pentire came along, and one of the other remarkable things about his victory in the Grand Annual, he'd only ever competed in one steeplechase prior to the Grand Annual, and that was 3 years earlier, and he didn't get round. So that was his second start in a steeplechase, and he'd bowed a tendon pretty bad, and just came up with this theory that stem cell, bit of the old, bit of the new, stem cells, cold water therapy up at Matty Feces for a month, good hard red blister, both tendons, 3 months out, and repeated it over and over, probably five times. Came into work probably in November, and that was when I started him for getting him ready for May. And he had 13 trials in total. His last six trials were only over three trial days because he at Pakenham, he ran second in a hurdle trial at 10 o'clock and ran third in a steeple trial 2 hours later, 2,800. Cranbourne, he did the same. I think he ran fourth and third, same day, 2,800, 2 hours later. And then at Warrnambool, exactly a week before the Grand Annual, he ran second in a hurdle trial at 10. No, he was jog-trotting. He ran third in the steeple trial. And I was watching the trial with Craig Durden. He said, I think I might have just watched the Grand Annual winner. I said, yeah, which one? He goes, yeah. He elbowed me and said, you know which one. So a lot of miles had gone into him. And the theory behind that was a tendon is a fatigue injury. And Brian Gath told me when I was up at Sutton Grange, he said, horses love lots of light work. He said, don't try and get a horse fit on an hour, doing an hour's work with him of a morning, especially if you've got a leg injury, break it up. So his morning would be like on the Tuesday before the Grand Annual, trotted and cantered two laps of the big sand at 4 o'clock. Had a hose, a walk. Jade DeRose jumped on him an hour later. He ran 1,000 in 1-1 on the sand. And I jumped in the car to go to Warrnambool. I said, what do you think, Jade? She said, win an open mile welter on that work. And then he arrived at Warrnambool after lunch, and I'd had my runners because they started very early. And I jumped on him and took him down to Port Fairy. And he waded through the water for an hour. And not, at no stage did he do hard enough work to have his bum dragging on the ground or be exhausted. Every bit of work he did, he coped so well. And as you just said, he ran brilliant time. He won by 12, and had it been 6 kilometres, he would have won by half a furlong.
And you felt the full force of the anti-jumping lobby that particular day. It was a dramatic day. Jumping and the jumping fraternity and the way that jumping races were conducted, were to be conducted for the future, a lot of things had to change. They put in a certain sort of list of KPIs to make sure that the jumping trainers and the jumping fraternity met the requirements of what Racing Victoria put out there. What's the state of play now? Does it still have a future?
There was only one problem. They made a lot of suggestions with the KPI, going slower, watering tracks. There was so many ridiculous trialling. On a certain amount of times, and all they had to do was have the hurdles that fell forward. In that 10-year period, we lost an astronomical amount of horses, and the injuries were so typical. The horses were getting tired and they'd just drop a front leg at the last or the second last and expecting the obstacle to fall forward. And if they got hung up in that steel A-frame, they were trying to land on one front leg. Well, as soon as I try and land on one front leg, next thing down was their head. No, just horse after horse after horse. And I got so upset by what I could see was very easy to see. I said to Steve Pateman, when you go to your meeting today, this is in about February, I said, tell them we're not going to run any horses over those steel A-frames. We want the hurdles that are hammered in. And if a horse hits them hard enough, the hurdle falls forward. So Steve, give him his credit. He took that to the committee, and they tried to sort of bluff him out of it. They said, well, if you want that, the jumping season will be held up by a month. And it was held up for a month, and the fatalities and falls since then have been minimal.
Yeah, certainly worked. It was common sense as well. Rob, the Derby 2013 with Polanski. Gee, there's a horse. What might have been?
Yeah, I firmly believe he could have been a Northerly or a Might and Power. He was so good. Bit freakish. By Racty, who was unsuccessful. Racty had died. That was one of the reasons I bought him. They always throw a good one. He just waltzed away with the Derby. Beat Criterion and Complacent by panels of fencing. Came back in the autumn. Paced it with Lankin Rupee. 46 for half a mile. Had improved lengths. And then this business of running the good races at the end of the day, 5:30, Futurity, put his foot in a pothole and ruptured his tendon. All over.
Gee. All comes crashing down, doesn't it? Lord of the Sky, a horse who social media seems to want to destroy all the time, and I don't for the life of me understand it. A horse has won nearly a million. Restricted breathing. Tell me about Lord of the Sky.
Yeah, well, they say any press is good press. Don't know about that, especially when you're trying to kick off his stud career, in a season or two. But he'd run through a brick wall for you. He's not weak. He had pneumonia as a yearling. He's got limited breathing. We've got a nebulizer on him like he looks like the equine version of Christopher Skase most mornings at the track, hooked up to a bottle, trying to get his lungs right for race day. And I've seen him on days where he's been beaten. He'll come back to scale. He's on the point of collapse, And you see these things. Oh, he's a dog. He don't try. I mean, I've seen horses that don't try. They pull up the opposite. Yeah. They wouldn't blow a candle out. They jig-jog out of the mounting yard and they've had a loan of you. But no, he gives his all. He's very, very quick. He's rated as the fastest end tire in Australia, probably still. Blistering speed. He would have been retired if he had gone 2 inches better in the TJ Smith, beaten an inch by Chautauqua. Picked up enormous stake money for that. He's actually won over $1 million now, Brian. He's won a Monash Stakes. He won a Bletchingly. He carried 59 in a Standish, second in a Christmas Handicap, second in the Goodwood at Group 1 level. He's got a terrific rap on his career when you write it down. So look, in Australia we breed for speed, and he's gonna, obviously, when he does finally retire to stud, he'll be a source of speed.
So Sibon, you threw him in the deep end, put him against the older horses in the last couple of weeks at Sandown. He darted up on the inside, looked as though he'd go close to winning. But he's come a long way in a short space of time.
Yeah, he's had seven starts. 6 weeks ago, he won a maiden on the synthetic at Pakenham. Down on the Mornington Peninsula, we were really disadvantaged this year. We had so much rain, trials called off. Finally got him over to a midweeker at Sandown, saddled him up. Horse slipped in the race before, called off, go home. So, I'm going to have to run him on the synthetic. So he went there, won. 10 days later, Guinea's Prelude, flashed home, beaten 1.7. Probably a certainty beaten. Maybe not a certainty beaten. Should have run in the first three in the Caulfield Guineas. Ran in the Vase on a unsuitable wet track. Run third, beat Prized Icon pretty easily. We drew 9 in the Derby. Problem with 9 is when there's a field of 18, when they load the barriers, 1 goes in, 9 goes in. So he goes in first, missed the kick by 2. At the 1800 metre mark, ran into the back of Kieran Maher's horse and just lost 3 or 4 lengths just immediately. Give him 15 length start. Look, I thought he was going to win at the 200, 300, zooming between horses. And to be fair, his last 50 he knocked up. I was going to tip him out, but high winds, I didn't want him going through a fence out in the paddock, just jogged him. And the track work riders said, this horse feels better this week than he did before the Derby. And I'm thinking, Count Ricardo, third in the Derby, won the Sandown Classic. So look, we went that way. And for the horse's education and his mentality, has been a terrific idea. He was so relaxed at Sandown. I still would have preferred him to come down the outside rail like Craig did half an hour earlier on Morton's Fork.
Seemed to be the best ground out there, didn't it?
Yeah, but I've got a theory on Sandown. I've been going there since the mid-60s, and the camber is, the outside of the track's higher than the inside. They water it. They tell me when I was at school that water goes downhill, so the inside's always a bit wetter. But even if it's not wetter, if you make the corner even 4 or 5 off and you have the opinion the better going's 10 off, halfway up the straight trying to make a right out of a wrong, if you do a bit of a right-hand turn, you're actually running up a hill. Whereas horses that swoop from 12 off the fence, they get a whack around the bum by the jockeys at the 100 and they actually duck in. And they run downhill. I don't know how that all weighs up, but that's my theory on why the inside's no good.
That's why you've been a great trainer in your time, over 35 years of doing it. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning. It's great to hear your story. It's a good one, and lots of success.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Absolute pleasure.